came to you on recording here on WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. And the next 2.5 minutes may contain frank language or adult topics. And if you feel you might be offended by this, you should tune away right now and come back in 2.5 minutes for, I don't know, is this the end of Mansion for the Rat, or is this the beginning of the dustbin of history? It's our crumb and his cheap suit serenaders. It's a bawdy tune. So if you're going to be PO'd, turn away and come back in 2.5 minutes.
Was walking down the avenue, eating a hot tamale. He knew the world was round, oh, his balls hung to the ground, oh, that navigating, masturbating son of a bitch, Columbo. A girl ran from the alleyway, and who was that pursued her? The white of an egg ran down her leg, Columbo surely screwed her. Columbus went to the Queen of Spain to get a ship and cargo. I bet I'll be a son of a bitch if I don't bring back Chicago. He knew the world was round, oh. He sailed his ship around, oh, that masticating, masturbating son of a bitch, Columbo. Hold tight, Mr. Kiss Columbus. He was much at sea without a humpus. He got a pain in his cucumbers. Up spoke Mr. Chris Columbus. All he does is stand until I reach land. I must get a hand from someone in the band. Christie took one glance and quickly saw his chance when a blushing man dropped his pants for romance. Christie said, now bend down, mister, and remember if this should pain, it's for Spain. And it was not in vain when the man bent down. Christie went to town. How the crew did cheer as he worked from the rear. For 40 days and 40 nights they sailed in search of booty. They spied a whore on a pagan shore. By God, she was a beauty. Over the rails by heads and tails, shedding their shirts and collars. In 14 minutes by the clock she made $900. You know the world was round, oh. His pants were hanging down, oh, that flagellating, masturbating son of a bitch, Columbo. Hold tight, Mr. Chris Columbus. Hooray, hooray for the new world's first good humpus.
WBAI, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I think you guys are doing a terrific job. There's some wonderful people overnight. I think Matt Schneeb is brilliant, and R. Paul Martin is brilliant, but I don't know how many people get to hear them. And I want to say thanks. That's a tremendous job.
Well, thank you very much for that.
Once again, boys and girls, welcome to another edition of the Dustbin of History. I'm your janitor and curator, Max Schmid. Great show for you today. The start of a new zero-hour serial, the one with Howard Duff as a detective in the Princess Stakes murder. Then, an earlier episode of The Vanishing Point in the series we just concluded. We're going back to 1985 for their version of The Yellow Wallpaper, and our lost episode of Gene Shepherd for this morning from 1969, recorded in Boston via syndication a week after it was broadcast on WOR. Beneath Your Feet, that's what it's called, and if there's time, I think we can squeeze in a little extra Gene Shepherd this morning, or some music, we shall see. But let's begin with Howard Duff, starring in the Hollywood Radio Theater, The Zero Hour, The Princess Stakes Murder, originally broadcast on November 26, 1973, at least in New York. There's a dead jockey, and mayhem follows. Along with Howard Duff, we have Julie Adams, Ray Danton, Jack Crucian, Walter Tetley, Herb Vigran, Lou Krugman, and Carl Svensson. So let's hear episode one of The Princess Stakes Murder from The Zero Hour. To start off this episode of The Dustbin of History here on WBAI New York.
I'm Rod Serling. You're listening to The Zero Hour. Rest your eyes. Exercise your imagination. This week, Ken Platt's Gymkhana Foul Play. The Princess Stakes Murder. Starring Howard Duff. Julie Adams. And Ray Danton. Elliot Lewis's production of The Zero Hour.
The Mutual Broadcasting System presents The Zero Hour. Sponsored in part by Chevrolet and State Farm Insurance. This is The Zero Hour on Mutual Radio.
The This week's story takes us into the fascinating realm of horses, jockeys, big money, big passions, the racetrack. We are about to meet Max Roper, private detective, and a good one. He's a man with a style. Subtlety isn't part of it. He's a gut reaction operative who acts upon what he calls feelings. If given the choice, one would be better off as his friend rather than an enemy. Max Roper had a friend, a little friend, a jockey, and a good one. Some called him the best. But sometimes the best just isn't good enough, especially when you're dead. Our story, The Princess Stakes Murder, begins after this word.
Ma'am, we're asking people what they know about different organizations.
Oh, good. Ask me anything about that.
All right. What's the ISAZP?
It's the International Society of Austrian Zither Players.
Right. Not many people know that one.
Give me another.
What does the Supreme Order of Federated Alliances do?
Oh, the same stuff as the Benevolent American Orders Associated Guild Society.
I never heard of that group.
I just made it up.
All right. Now, here's a serious one. Name two things the American Cancer Society is involved in besides cancer research.
Wow. They're into so many. Many things, like educating the public to the warning signals of cancer and professional education for doctors and nurses and dentists and service for patients.
Right, and lots more. And that's why the American Cancer Society needs financial support to continue its drive to wipe out cancer in our lifetime.
Well, I certainly support them.
Good.
Now, here's one for you. What's the LLTA?
I give up.
The League of Lady Tattoo Artists.
You made that up.
No, I'm a member. How'd you like a picture of Miller Fillmore tattooed on your elbow?
It's taken already.
Oh. They're in the stretch, and Calamity has the lead. Humble Hilda holding back. Sister Sally moving up. It's Sister Sally and Calamity. Calamity stepping out, pulling away. It's Calamity by a length.
It's always nice to win, even when you bet on the favorite. It was a big win all around, for Calamity, her owner, the trainer, but mostly for Willie Rich, the veteran jockey and an old friend of mine. I'd driven down to Del Mar from L.A. because of Willie, as a matter of fact. He'd called me the night before, wanted to see me. Nothing special, he'd said. I played it close, put down $2 on him, made 80 cents. But Willie wasn't around after the race like he said he'd be. That didn't make any sense at all. So I asked Allie Regal about it. Regal used to be a top government agent. Now he was chief of Del Mar Security. Hey, Allie.
Max. What's up? Hey, you're a long way from home.
Not much. Came down to watch Willie ride.
That's worth the trip.
Yeah, you see him?
Saw him in the winner's circle.
After that?
After that? Well, no, that's funny.
What's funny?
I don't remember seeing Willie dress or nothing. You know, these little guys maybe got lost.
Yeah. I was bugged on the drive back to L.A. and not just from the Labor Day traffic. Willie was a little guy, all right, but he walked tall and always said what he meant. And he'd said he wanted to see me. I had the uneasy feeling that there was a reason for Willie not meeting me after the eighth race. Men in my line of work get those feelings sometimes. 7 o'clock the next morning, my telephone started jumping out of the cradle. Yeah. I'll never get in shape this way. Roper here.
Max, it's Ollie.
Yeah. Hear from Willie?
Heard from his wife.
She hear from him?
Saw him. He don't swim near as good as he rides.
Give it to me, Ollie.
Well, it seems she went for a little midnight swim in their pool. Nearly landed on him.
Was he dead already?
Very.
Thanks, Ollie. Hang around, will you? I'm on my way.
From what I was told, you could hear her screaming for 8 miles. I got there at 1 a.m. The track physician, Dr. Taniguchi, figures that Willie died somewhere between 10 and 11.
Let's start with the obvious. His wife giving him a hard time?
He wouldn't have killed himself over that. I can't see Penny wanting him out of the way either. He let her roam, didn't he? He was always worth more booting home the winners. Now, why would she want him dead?
Yeah, maybe she wants the pool all to herself when she gets home late nights. The owner, Tyler Clayton, what can you tell me about him?
Let's see, he owns Calamity and several other nags. Tough, pig-headed man, he wants what he wants when he wants it.
Willie been his rider for long?
About 5 years.
Must have made Clayton a lot of money.
Sure, but Clayton doesn't need it.
I'll run over and see him. Maybe I'll find out what a rich guy like that really needs. Instead of going right to the Claytons, I decided to start with Willie Rich's widow, Penny. Willie's spread was at the end of a humpback dirt and gravel lane. It was expensive. Willie had booted home a lot of winners in his time and could afford the layout. The flashy little blonde at the far end of the pool, wearing very little of a strawberry bikini, looked like the most expensive bit of landscaping. She was wearing enormous sunglasses, smoking a joint. Mrs. Rich, my name is Max Roper. Maybe Willie mentioned my name. We were friends.
Everybody that calls says he was a friend of Willie's.
Well, he was a popular guy. Can you tell me anything about it?
What's to tell? He's dead, drowned in his own swimming pool.
Well, I'm trying to find out who had it in for Willie.
Who are you?
Private investigator. I'm here because Willie was a friend of mine. I want to find out who knocked him off.
That's a crock. For all anybody knows, Willie did it himself.
Well, why would he do that?
Ask him. We didn't talk much.
A man doesn't kill himself just because his marriage isn't worth it.
Why don't you get lost?
Maybe somebody was trying to pressure him into something, you know. Maybe they were worrying him.
They? Who's they?
I was hoping you'd tell me, Mrs. Rich.
Go to hell and don't bother to come back.
I'll drop in again sometime when you're over your grief. As I approached my car, a man was just getting out of his. Husky, dark-haired, pallid, a clothes horse. His features rough and crude, but not anywhere near his own real personality. We'd never been formally introduced, but I was well acquainted with his reputation. Johnny Cascio, a reliable enforcer for the mob. We brushed shoulders as he walked by, and he flipped his hand in salute. I half expected there'd be a knife in it. If he was a friend of the widow Rich, he was moving in too fast for my taste. I sat in my car for a minute just thinking. Then I looked into my rearview mirror. Johnny Cascio had stopped. He was standing there, watching me.
We know these are times when you're rightfully concerned about the selection and use of a car. As the number one selling car in America this year, and for 37 out of the last 43 sales years, we felt we should speak up. And one of the things to be said is Chevrolet makes sense for America, especially now. We've always built our cars in response to your needs. And now, when you're asking, should I trade in my car for a smaller one, or does it make sense to continue to drive a regular-sized car, you'll find some satisfying answers by looking to your own requirements and to Chevrolet's line of cars. For the family that needs plenty of room, an Impala or a Chevy wagon offers the same kind of value that a Vega offers the person with smaller needs. And so it goes through the full line of cars and trucks. Even in light of our country's energy situation and the uncertainty that surrounds it, we're producing the cars and trucks that make sense for America.
We'll return to our story in a moment.
Hello, I'm Johnny Cash, and I've been around this great country of ours enough to know how important it is to get as much education as you can while you're young. If you want to start college or vocational school, this may be your chance. The government wants to give you some money if you have financial need. Can you believe that? Well, it's true. Look into a new program called Basic Grants to see if you qualify. Hurry on over to the county agent, post office, or nearest school for more information and an application form. A basic grant won't give you all the money you need to make it through college or vocational training, but it'll help you get on the road. It could be the most important road you'll ever walk in your entire life. And if you don't feel like walking, just write your name and address on the back of a postcard and mail it to Basic Grants, Post Office Box 84, Washington, D.C., 20044. That's Basic Grants, Post Office Box 84, Washington, D.C., 20044.
Rancho Santa Fe is a serene valley catering to the extreme tastes of millionaires, horse lovers who like their pictures taken in the winner's circle. Tyler C. Clayton was the millionaire I wanted to see. He stood an easy 6'5 or 6, went about 250. The man was a real big daddy.
I liked Willie, Mr. Roper. Liked having him work for me. Damn good jockey. What do you drink?
Bourbon. You think, will he drown himself, Mr. Clayton?
Hell no. Why would he do that? Big money-winning rider, good for a lot of years.
Maybe you can give me a line on Willie's enemies.
Enemies? He didn't have a one. Everybody liked Willie. Here you go.
Thank you. Somebody didn't. Drowning a guy isn't exactly a demonstration of friendship.
Sure wish I could help you.
Clayton's eyes strayed past me. I turned my head and saw why. A woman had appeared in the open doorway. A strawberry blonde in her late 30s, quite beautiful, wearing expensive casual threads. As she acknowledged the introduction to me, she put her hand gracefully to her throat. A small gesture that triggered something in my memory.
Oh, dear, perhaps we should speak to Mr. Roper. Mr. Regal recommended him.
No, Monica, I don't think there's any need to...
Please, Tyler.
All right, if you have to, spill it.
Mr. Roper, we have a problem. It's Tyler's daughter, Pamela. She's been missing since yesterday.
I'm sorry to hear that. How old is the girl?
22.
That makes her old enough.
Old enough for what?
To leave home.
She had a beauty appointment, a health spa in Poway called the Gilded Cuckoo. But she never got there.
Have you notified the police?
No.
Any particular reason why not, Mr. Clayton? I mean, your daughter disappearing the same day Willie Rich was murdered?
What are you implying?
Well, I'm not trying to worry you, but that's the line the police would take.
Are you suggesting that Pamela's been kidnapped?
No, but, somebody could have tried to coerce you about a horse and got even because you wouldn't give in.
Just you find her and stop asking so damn many fool questions. I don't believe a damn word you're saying, and that's the last time... that's the last you're going to get out of me.
I'm sorry, Mr. Roper.
No, sorry. You have a picture of the girl, Mrs. Clayton?
Right over there, in the silver frame.
By the way, was that your mare, Sister Sally, that got beaten by Calamity, your husband's filly?
Calamity didn't beat her. Willie Rich did.
Would you say that would be reason enough for you to kill Willie, Mrs. Clayton?
No, Mr. Roper. I wouldn't.
The Gilded Cuckoo in Poway only proved that business in narcissism was booming. These out-of-town spas were good for kicking habits with drugs and booze high up on the list, followed by weight and body conditioning for cosmetic vanity. I was leafing through folders that listed available courses without the humdrum detail of prices when the director pranced in.
Oh, Mr. Roper, I'm George Glendon. I direct the activities of our little sanctuary. Now, how might we help you?
Well, I like to eat, drink, and I sit around a lot. How long would it take to put me in shape?
Well, that all depends on your cooperation. See, with our program, your muscles may scream and tell you that you're being tortured. But believe me, they're going to tone up. See, we believe in the brain, the body, and the soul, all stimulated and fused into creativity and love to attain the perfect body.
I'll buy that, but how long does it take?
Well, there's Plan A. It's a 12-lesson course. Oh, we do marvelous work with ozone treatment and face vacuuming.
Face vacuuming?
That's what I said. Face vacuuming. Self-love, my liege, is not so vile as self-neglect. And that's Henry V. You know, Shakespeare?
Yes, I know.
Well, why don't we look around? Now, you'll be able to decide far easier after you've seen our facilities.
The look around was a revelation. A fully equipped gym that didn't smell any better than my gym in Santa Monica. Mineral springs, baths, face packs, men and women hovered over by attendants, and a plastic surgery wing. Then we zeroed in on something called the Isotron room. Through a one-way mirror, Glendon and I looked into a bare room furnished with only a long white couch and a machine called the Isotron. The man lying on the couch was stripped down to his trunks. Contact pads ran from his body to the machine. A man wearing a white coat flipped the switch, and the face of the man on the couch contorted. The pads covering his body jiggled. His arms, shoulders, back, stomach, and leg muscles went into massive contractions.
The man in the white coat is our Isotron specialist, Dr. Savage.
Well, that figures.
Oh, there is no pain. No, it is the body's natural reaction.
Yeah, what happens if that guy in the white coat falls asleep during a session?
Well, then we'd have a very well-developed corpse. But, of course, that would never happen. See, it's all automatic. Now, do you perhaps have any questions?
Yes, one. It's about Miss Pamela Clayton.
Are you a friend of the Claytons?
More like a friend of a friend. I understand Pamela had an appointment with her hairstylist yesterday at 10:30, and she canceled out. Would you know anything about it?
Is this important?
I'd say so. She's been missing for 24 hours. I happen to be in the neighborhood and told Mr. and Mrs. Clayton I'd check it out.
Well, then why don't we find out? I'd like to look at your appointment book, Miss Hill. Yesterday morning, you said?
Yes, about 10:30.
Well, there must be some mistake. Miss Clayton wasn't scheduled for an appointment. See, at 10:30, we have a Mr. H. Masson down for Mr. K. That's Miss Clayton's usual hairdresser. Well, here, see for yourself.
Well, thanks. Sorry I troubled you.
No trouble at all. I don't suppose we'll be seeing you again, Mr. Ropal.
Oh, I wouldn't say that. A lot of what I saw here interests me. I might be back sooner than you think. I stood outside as the gilded doors closed behind me. That isopron machine in there, twisting and turning the human being into a shapeless mass. Whether it built muscles or not, I didn't know. But there was one thing I was sure of. It could tear a man apart.
Largest company, and you don't get to be the largest company unless you're doing a little extra for people.
Agent Bill Rich of Logan, Utah, explains why State Farm Mutual is the world's largest car insurer.
This is what the consumer feels, and you know that if a consumer feels State Farm is number one, it's got to be on two things, service and price. And if you're not competitive in both of these areas and do the job, the customer is not going to rate them where they have. Rule number one, we only got there because we were most competitive or as competitive as anyone, and because we're there to serve.
Service and price. That's what car insurance value is all about. And there are two good reasons to see your nearby State Farm agent now.
Like a good neighbor.
The Zero Hour continues after this.
I'd like you to ask yourself a personal question. What do you feel when you meet a handicapped person? Pity? Admiration? Fear? Are you from the school that teaches a stiff upper lip, try harder, fight, don't let anything stand in your way, do it? Do what? Learn a skill? Go to school? Develop confidence, self-respect? Then get turned down by a landlord who doesn't believe you'll pay the rent? By an employer who never hired the handicapped before and who isn't going to risk it now? If we don't believe in the handicapped, then how are they going to believe in themselves? Unless we recognize that they're human beings with feelings, with skills, with a sense of responsibility, then we're adding a handicap that they can't overcome. Let's stop handicapping the handicapped. This public service message brought to you on behalf of the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare and the Advertising Council.
The sun warmed my back. Horses stomped lazily in their stalls. I was looking for Joey Zale, a jockey that had been thrown only once, and that one time enough to end his career. I found Joey Zale cleaning a stall. I noticed his hands as he lit a cigarette. They were huge. Above the waist, Zale was a middleweight. Only his crippled legs were pipe-stem thin. His face and body carried a twisted snarl. You Joey Zale?
Yeah. What are you, the heat?
Private Dick. Willie Rich is a friend of mine.
Too bad it didn't do him any good.
Can we talk?
Talk.
Do you think Willie killed himself?
If he did, he could have done it right here. He didn't need no pool. He hated water.
Could he swim?
It's hard if somebody's holding your head under.
Good point, Joey. Who did it to him?
I heard of you, Roper. I know your scene. Hell, if you don't know who did it to Willie, we all got trouble.
I need a lead, Joey. Anything. Anybody.
You got one already.
Willie's wife?
I don't think so. You've been to Clayton's, haven't you?
You mean the daughter, Pam?
Now you're cooking. Only don't ask me why, because I don't know.
Were they close? Willie and Pam Clayton?
That's your business. Find out.
Joey Zale was right. It was my business. I started out by trying to find the H. Masson who had Pam Clayton's 10:30 appointment at the Gilded Cuckoo. No dice, no listing, no nothing. I called the Claytons. They were out, and the Scandinavian maid told me Pam hadn't come back. I was going in a circle, so I decided to get home and start over again. When I walked into my apartment in Santa Monica, the phone was ringing. Roper here.
Max, Allie Regal. Say, I heard something about Willie and Pam Clayton.
Like what?
Like maybe they had a thing for each other.
So I've heard. Tell me something about Mrs. Clayton.
What's to tell? A lot of money, doesn't like a stepdaughter.
Yeah. Something else, Allie. I got the strangest feeling I know her.
Of course you do. It's Monica Moore. Pretty big movie star 15 years ago. Mostly B pictures. Her career went down the drain. Men, mostly. A lot of booze, maybe some drugs. A few bad marriages.
Thanks, Allie. Let me know if you get a lead on Pam Clayton, will you?
Yeah, I was going to ask you to do the same.
After I hung up, I called on a theatrical agent pal of mine, Sid Pinter. Asked him what he could tell me about Monica Moore. I struck gold. He had a complete file on her. A stack of old 8x10 publicity stills. She's been out of pictures a long time, Sid. How come you have these photos?
Me? I'm a string saver. I save junk, memories.
This picture, who's the guy with it?
Oh, that's Johnny Hunter, her first husband. Family owned part of Texas and half of Wyoming. Here's number two, the cowboy star, Rex Lennox.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that didn't last long. And this is number three, the hotel man. You know, Chilson, Charles Chilson.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she got a big bundle from him. And this is number four, Muscles. Lance Kite, former Mr. America, Mr. Universe.
I suppose that one didn't last long either.
Nah, all he had was his muscle flexing act. Well, after him, it was all downhill for Monica. She quit show business. Got into religion instead. Astral and cosmic magnetism. You should excuse the expression. I'm trying to think of the guy's name. It was Charnick. Yeah, Lewis Charnick. He gave public lectures. Helped you find the miracle in your life. You know, that kind of nonsense.
Monica Moore joined up with Charnick?
Well, it was more like she backed him. You know, a lot of people take that stuff seriously. Anyway, that's about all I know. I haven't heard a word from or about her since.
She's in Clover, Sid. Big oil man, number five, Tyler Clayton.
Oh, well, I'm glad. She was a beautiful kid. They racked her up good in this town. You know, the scandal nearly ruined her.
What scandal?
Her first husband killed himself.
Johnny Hunter?
Yeah, sleeping pills, overdosed.
Is this Charnick character still operating?
I see his name in the paper time to time.
Thanks, Sid. See you around.
Yeah, well, don't thank me. Every time you come here for some cockamamie information, somebody jumps you and knocks your head in.
Not this time. I'm investigating the death of Willie Rich.
The jockey? What's Monica Moore got to do with that?
I don't know. Maybe nothing. It's just that Monica's stepdaughter disappeared the same day Willie Rich was murdered. I'm trying to find out who killed Willie and locate the girl.
You should live so long.
I was nursing a beer in my digs a little later, and I was flipping through the entertainment section of the local sheet, wondering how I was going to kill the evening when I came across the ad. Charnick, tonight, Wilshire Playhouse, 8 o'clock. There was a picture of Charnick on the wall in the playhouse lobby. He looked young, tall, dark, and handsome. The lights dimmed, and a chunky, broad-shouldered man dressed in white came out of the wings and sat down at the organ. Then the spotlight came on, and Charnick appeared. He wasn't young like the picture in the lobby, around 50. His eyes were dark, intense, his voice mellifluous, and he knew how to use it. Didn't waste a word. He knew where the money was. The large audience was still and attentive. When the lecture was over, I got out as fast as I could. I waited near the alley where I could watch the back entrance. A big black limousine was parked there, a burly, tough-looking driver behind the wheel. In a few minutes, Charnick came out, got into the car, and it started forward. As it slowly passed by, I saw there was a passenger in the back seat. A female passenger, none other than Monica Clayton. So, Charnick and Monica, and Willie Rich and Pam Clayton. Two here, and two gone. I was getting another one of those feelings. Didn't like it much. It felt like murder, with more to come.
You are listening to Mutual's presentation of The Zero Hour.
Your Heart Association presents Stiller and Mira.
Honey, I'm going to test you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you have high blood pressure, what are the things you should do?
Watch your weight.
Right.
Follow your doctor's instructions on smoking.
Yeah.
Take your medicine.
Good.
Get plenty of rest.
Terrific. Hey, honey, let's stay home tonight, huh?
And exercise, but don't overdo it.
Right. We'll stay home tonight, okay? Okay?
Yeah, and you got to rest before you get tired, right?
Exactly. So we'll stay home tonight, okay?
Okay, we'll stay home tonight.
Terrific.
Hey, wait a minute.
What?
You don't happen to have high blood pressure, do you?
Me? Of course not. I have my checkup at the doctor. I'm terrific. And I made an appointment for you.
Why?
Because I love you. And only a doctor can tell.
Another way to protect your loved ones is to give to the Heart Fund.
There was a time when the rivers, the earth, and the sky of America were pure. A time when the only American was the Indian. Today, America is suffering from pollution. But the problem isn't hopeless. We can protect the natural beauty of America if you get involved. Something as simple as using the fuel rated most efficient for the engine of your car. Or planting trees to help purify the air and prevent soil erosion. Or starting a compost heap instead of burning leaves or trash. People start pollution. People can stop it. This message has been brought to you on behalf of Keep America Beautiful and this station.
Tomorrow at this time, rest your eyes and listen here to this week's continuing study in suspense, The Princess Stakes Murder. I'm Ron Sterling, and this is The Zero Hour.
This is The Zero Hour on Mutual Radio.
Been listening to The Zero Hour, a presentation of the Mutual Broadcasting System in association with Hollywood Radio Theater, heard every weekday at this time. Rod Serling is your host. Zero Hour is produced and directed by Elliot Lewis. The Hollywood Radio Theater theme was played by Ferranti and Teicher and is now available on United Artists Records and Tapes. Hugh Douglas speaking. Tune in tomorrow. And once again,
rest your eyes and listen here
to The Zero Hour. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.
And we'll have at least one more chapter of The Princess Stakes Murder on next week's program. The program is The Dustbin of History. You're tuned to WBAI New York. And now, an episode of Vanishing Point from the earlier version of the series, maybe the original version of The Vanishing Point, from Canadian Broadcasting on May 10th, 1985. It's the 31st episode of the series. It's The Yellow Wallpaper, and if I had time, I'd tell you more about it. Early feminist story. So here it is, Vanishing Point. In the Dustbin of History, WBAI, New York.
I'm thinking of redecorating. I'd appreciate your opinion. The place is so old, in need of that personal touch to bring it back to life, so to speak. Perhaps you should stay the night. get a better sense of what you're up against. Oh, I'll be around if you need me. You can find me in the room at the end of the hall, beyond the door marked The Vanishing Point.
Well, love, it isn't often that people like ourselves secure ancestral halls for the summer.
There was some legal trouble. I believe something about heirs and co-heirs. The place has been empty for years.
There's something strange about the house. I can feel it. A deserted colonial mansion. I might even say a haunted house.
Oh, no, you mustn't let your imagination run wild, my dear.
An hereditary estate.
Oh, yes, it'll be a fine place for you to rest and take the air this summer, Catherine. I hope it will provide no unnecessary distractions. Well, here we are.
I didn't mean.
Here, I'll help you down.
John, I...
Come along. Let's go inside. And remember, no seeing faces in the woodwork.
Oh, John. I didn't feel the least bit sleepy today after lunch, so I begged Jenny to let me deviate a little from the routine we have established. You see, John insists that I lie down for an hour after each meal, but I'm afraid I don't sleep. So I persuaded Jenny that if she'd just let me take a good ramble in the garden, I might truly exhaust myself and get some rest. Finally. It is the most peculiar garden here. Full of overgrown pathways and tumble-down hedges and gates that lock. Who would think to want a padlock in a rose garden? Just a moment ago, I found myself in a small enclosure, and the gate swung shut behind me. I escaped by crawling under a bit of hedge and found myself here in this little arbor. There is what looks like a ruined abbey wall and grass growing up through the crevices. The stones are worn smooth. By the rain, I guess. I will hide up here. I'll curl myself up tightly on the ledge and peruse the view. I have on an old green dress and a brown cardigan, so I am perfectly camouflaged. I've barely disappeared.
Catherine! Catherine!
Now I can hear Jenny coming. She is coming to see what has become of me. I can hear her cheeks getting redder and redder as she approaches. Jenny is John's sister. This summer she is looking after us.
Catherine!
I can't bring myself to answer her.
And where have you gotten to?
Catherine!
You gave me such a fright. What on earth are you doing up there?
Just getting some sun.
But you're in the shade.
Oh. Well, it moved, I guess. The sun. In the sky.
Did you pass a comfortable night, Catherine?
Yes, thank you.
Does the room at the top of the house suit you?
I do have an excellent view. From one window, I can see the garden. And from another, I get a lovely view of the bay. I always fancy I can see people walking in the garden. But of course, it's just the wind.
You shouldn't give way to such fancies, Catherine, in your condition. John wouldn't like it.
Please pass the butter. What exactly is my condition, Jenny? No one has ever properly explained it to me.
My brother is the doctor. You must look to him for your explanations.
I'm not really very hungry, Jenny. I think I will go upstairs and lie down.
I will call you for lunch.
Yes. Yes. This room, the room that John and I have chosen for a bedroom, is at the very top of the house. I think it used to be the nursery, for there is a little gate at the head of the stairs. From here I can see Jenny coming a long way off. I'm like a pilot on the bridge, scanning for storms on the horizon. I'm sure the garden was designed as a maze at one point. I can't have been the first to have gotten lost in it. Perhaps some amorous bridegroom planned it as a diversion for his novelty-seeking young wife. Just as John planned our stay here as a diversion for me, so that I might get perfect rest and exercise and not worry my head about silly things that do not concern me. John is very loving and kind and hardly lets me stir without special direction. I feel basely ungrateful not to value it more. I can't be the first to grow restless on a holiday. Lake Lugano, the Italian Sea of Dreams, the romantic poet's sojourn during the rainy season. Oh, it rains endlessly. Mary Shelley suggests they all try their hands at writing ghost stories. Byron smiles indulgently at her. But his turned out to be quite awful. Very bad indeed. Mary and Percy Bysshe. Or was it Bysshe? Bysshe? Mary and Percy. They were very romantic. Late at night, she turns to him and says, "In my story, a great scientist will succeed in creating life in the laboratory." "Hush now, my dear," Percy purrs as he rolls over in his sleep. "But he won't be able to love his creation. It will be a monster who will haunt him for the rest of his days." "Percy? Percy? Sleep now, my dear, and don't tire yourself. You're not strong, remember." But she outlived him.
Ah, Jenny, I'm off. Take good care of our patient.
Are you out again this evening, John?
Yes, I'm afraid so.
We were to play cards. Catherine will be so disappointed.
Jenny, you know I have come here solely on her account so that she may get perfect rest and exercise, but I cannot be with her all the time.
No, of course. But sometimes I don't feel up to keeping company with her. She craves excitement, books, concerts.
The very worst thing for her at present.
But John...
I know she can be difficult at times, Jenny. She wants everything that is bad for her. Nervous disorders are the hardest to treat. And worst of all, one never knows if the patient is entirely cured.
I'll get your coat.
Thank you. Don't wait up for me. I shall be late tonight.
Very well.
Oh, look at this. If it doesn't let up, I may stay in the village.
Sometimes I think it is not such a bad thing to be forced to examine life through a pinprick. It's not good to let in too much light all at once, to be blinded. No, better just to let in one narrow shaft, just enough to show the way. Ah, there is a cobweb in my water jug. A cobweb. Illicitly attracting dust. Hello. A dead fly. A casualty should be reported to the Missing Persons Bureau. No doubt by this time he's become a folk hero in the eyes of the young. They'll speak bravely of the days when good old Harry was still around. I'm sure they'll miss him among the flies. My lunch seems to be digesting itself quite adequately. Perhaps, however, I have become flushed. Powder, or they'll make me go upstairs and rest again. On the other hand, if I'm too pale, they'll make me go upstairs and rest again. I'll make a bet with myself. If John doesn't come home tonight, for sometimes he doesn't, if his case is serious, I'll treat myself to another ramble in the garden, Jenny or no Jenny. And if he does come home and reads to me, I'll ask him if we can go and visit Cousin Henry and Julia soon, for it would do me so much good to get out for a while. I'll be very composed. I'll meet all his objections logically. But John says he would sooner put firecrackers under my pillow than let me have stimulating company. I don't really like this room. It was a nursery. And I'm sure the children must have hated it because they've scratched and gouged the floor and the wallpaper. The plaster itself is dug out here and there. And this great bed looks as if it had been through the wars.
Ah, Jenny. How is she?
Inclined to be difficult, I'm afraid. You should go in.
Yes.
John?
Hello, my dear. See, I've brought you some grapes from the village. Well, it's not often they have such luxuries.
John, I don't like this room a bit.
Now, Catherine.
I like the one downstairs that opens on the piazza with the old-fashioned chintz hangings.
I won't hear of it, my dear. Why, there's only one window in that room, and it's covered with roses. You'd not get any light.
I like roses.
My dear, are you trying to be rid of me?
No.
There's not enough space for two beds in that room. Do you wish me to take another room?
No. But perhaps we could repaper this one. I find the pattern so irritating.
Darling.
I spend so much time here. Sometimes I think it will get the better of me.
It would be the worst thing I could do to give way to such fancies.
It would not be costly. I could do some of the work myself.
And as soon as we change the wallpaper, it would be the heavy bedstead you would want removed, and then the bars on the windows, and who knows, the gate at the head of the stairs, and so on.
This room has the oddest wallpaper. There is a recurrent spot where the pattern lolls like a broken neck, and two bulbous eyes stare at you upside down. I get positively angry with the impertinence of it and the everlastingness. Up and down and sideways they crawl, and those absurd, unblinking eyes are everywhere. The eyes... an aged professor reading from yellowing lecture notes. You're curled up at the edges. You're withered, depraved, decaying. We'd rather stare out the window. We'd rather look at the view. There is one place in this wallpaper where two pieces didn't match. And the eyes go all up and down the line, one a little higher than the other. This paper looks as if it knew what a vicious influence it had. I will simply refuse to see your broken necks and your bulbous heads. I see instead the blue mists of our earliest beginnings, the pre-classical, prehistoric age. Now there, where the spires are rising out of the darkness. Who cares if it's only the gouge marks where someone was careless moving the furniture? I insist that they are the domes and spires of Sir Christopher Wren. And who will prove me wrong? There is hope for humanity. There is hope in beauty and form and art and religion and order and discipline and regimen and routine and automation. You insist on going up and down and sideways with such precise, ugly movements. A machine run amok. You keep on delivering up your hideous product even when there's no demand. We would rather look out the window. We would rather look at the view. I mentioned to Jenny about the bars. On the windows, I said. And she said she hadn't noticed them. Well, they are as plain as day. I explained that this was because she had never thought to see bars in a nursery. And then she said, very wisely, for she is a dear, kind, wise thing in her own way.
Bars are there to keep bad things out, like burglars, and not to keep the little children in at all.
I can't seem to make them understand that the reason I don't sleep very well at night is because they make me sleep so much during the day. But John is a doctor and would understand such things.
You are poorly today, my dear. You look feverish.
I don't believe this place is really agreeing with me after all, John.
You wander about in the garden too much. Don't go out this evening. You'll catch a chill.
I wonder if we might leave a few weeks earlier than we had planned.
But, darling, the repairs wouldn't be finished at home if we left now. I hardly care to live with plaster and paint everywhere.
I am not happy here.
Be sensible, love. If we were in any danger, we would leave tomorrow. But I feel you are getting better, whether or not you like to admit it.
Yes. Yes, you are probably right. There is a sub-pattern in this wallpaper. Underneath the toadstools and Romanesque flourishes, If I could just catch it off guard, I might make out what it is. But you see, I've been deceived all this time. I used to think it was the pattern that upset me. But I've noticed in the evening it changes and becomes far less irksome. The strangling vines become soft ferns after dark. It is just a mindless meandering after all. I have discovered something about this paper. If it is a dark day and all the windows are sealed tight, you can smell the color. It gets in my clothes and stays in my hair, a soft, pungent yellow that plugs up my nose and makes me choke. It is your color I choke on. You were free to have chosen the yellow of a buttercup reflected under a child's chin. Or you could have been the yellow of an oil lamp swinging as a beacon for sailors. But you chose the sickening yellow, sulfur tint of depravity and decay. If I am sick, my tongue is coated yellow. And if I can't hear, my ears are filled with yellow. And if I throw up, the sick is yellow. And if my hair is yellow, it means I'm growing old, old, cowardly, cowardly color of pawnbrokers. Under a scab, it festers yellow. And I saw a corpse once in a dirty yellow whirlpool. And if the baby is yellow, it is because he's going to die. The baby has yellow hair. Beautiful yellow golden curls. Don't pull my hair. It takes such a long time to get it back up. I'm frightened. I'm just a little frightened.
Catherine? These marks. What has she been doing?
Uh-huh.
Good Lord.
I caught you, Jenny. I caught you looking at the paper.
What are you doing on the floor?
You were looking at the paper as if you knew. You know there is something strange about this paper.
Catherine, it was a cruel trick to frighten me so.
You'd look as if you'd been caught stealing.
This is too much.
Oh, yes?
Yes, there is something strange about this paper. It leaves yellow smooches all over your dresses, and I'm at my wit's end to know how to get them out.
I'm sorry.
You don't seem very sorry.
Discovered something about this wallpaper. Something that nobody else seems to notice for all they're looking at it. In places where it isn't faded and the sun is just so, I can see a strange, provoking, formless sort of figure that skulks about behind that silly, conspicuous front design. Sometimes I think I almost have it figured out. I've learned to be very logical about it. The difficulty is not knowing where it begins and where it ends. This is a fact of life with wallpaper. Unlike a still life or a bowl of fruit, which exists only once in its entirety, the paper is printed over and over. You think you have mastered it, but just as you begin to follow the pattern to its logical conclusion, it does a back somersault. It slaps you in the face, knocks you down, and tramples upon you. It is like a bad dream. It is a riddle, and I must think very fast in order to be able to catch it. If only I could put my hand through these bars, I might be able to catch the lady who runs behind. Here I come. I tried to catch her until I was out of breath, for she was very quick, and I was afraid to put my head out to call, for fear the children would find me and spoil the game. It got darker. I was never very good at hiding. No, that's not true. Once, I remember, I was hidden so well, I thought they'd all given up looking for me and gone home. But I didn't want to look out, just in case the game was still going on. I knew it was an oversight. Each one believed someone else had found me, and it got darker and darker. I had a lovely hiding place. There were branches and ferns and soft, dark earth, very close and around me. But I thought I saw something out of the corner of my eye. Some strange, quick-moving thing. I'm not like Jenny, who cannot see the most obvious thing because she will not see anything dark or foreboding. I couldn't see it really. I couldn't make it out. Strange. They forgot about me. At first I was afraid. The dark place. The branches gathered in around me and the grass grew up in between my fingers and toes. And it was as if I wasn't there. Or had always been there. And I didn't want to go home. I don't want to come out. I don't want to come out. It is so hard to talk to John about where I've been, because he is so wise and because he loves me so. But I tried it last night. It was moonlight. John. John. The moon shines in all around, just as the sun does. It creeps so slowly and always comes in by one window or another. The faint figure behind seems to shake the pattern as if she wanted to get out. I have discovered something, John, by watching so much at night. That woman gets out in the daytime. I can see her out of every one of my windows. It is the same woman, I know, for she is always creeping, and most women do not creep by daylight. There is a smooch mark all the way around this room. At night, in any kind of light, in twilight, candlelight, lamplight, and worst of all, by moonlight, it becomes bars. And the woman behind is as plain as can be. They have stuffed her head. They used lemon wax on her hair to make it shine, and raisins for eyes, baking soda for her teeth. But no jewelry, no, not until she was 18. And one day they found her outside. She had torn her stockings on the branches and twigs and stones where she had been hiding. Things are so much more exciting now than they used to be. Now that I have something to look forward to. They wouldn't let me have such company if they knew. No, they would rather pin me down and drive a stake through my heart. John says he would rather put firecrackers under my pillow than let me have stimulating company. So, of course, I'm very careful not to let on. John laughs at me about it. He says I seem to be getting better in spite of my wallpaper. Of course, I can't tell him it's because of it. So I must be very careful not to leave any trace. Not even on my daytime expressions. I have caught John and Jenny looking at the paper as if they knew there was something mysterious about it. They will check to see if my hair has come down, and if there is mud on my shoes, and if our stockings are torn, they'll know. They'll know we have been out in the garden overnight and have caught a chill. They will always be looking at you and checking on you, so you must be very discreet. And if you smile, you must have a tiny, wizened smile which betrays nothing. an embroidered smile. If those heads were covered or taken off, it would not be half so bad. I always lock the door when I creep by daylight. I can't do it at night, for I know John would suspect something at once. John is so strange now. I wish he would take another room. I don't want anyone to get that woman out at night but myself. Turn as fast as I can. I can only see her out of one window at a time. I have watched her sometimes, away off in the open country, creeping as fast as a cloud shadow in the high wind. As soon as it was moonlight, and that poor thing began to crawl and shake the pattern, I got up and ran to help her, and before morning we had pulled off yards of that paper. I pulled and she shook. I shook and she pulled, and before morning we had pulled off yards of that paper.
Oh, my God.
Look.
Catherine.
She's like an animal.
Catherine.
No one touches this paper but me.
All the paper torn down.
Catherine.
I don't like to look out of the windows even. There are so many of those creeping women, and they creep so fast. They all came out of the wallpaper as I did.
A place thoroughly lived in becomes internalized in a series of adjustments until it represents the person to herself. That's how one scholar puts it. What's your verdict? Can the place be made habitable again? You'll have to excuse the mess. The last occupant started to redecorate, but lost the will. She's in another room now. One she has internalized to the extent that she has become the room. Oh, it's an infinitely smaller room than this. The vanishing point.
The Yellow Wallpaper by Charlotte Perkins Gilman. Adapted for radio by Mary Vingo. Featured in the cast were Mary Vingo as Catherine, Michael Fox as John, and Joyce Campion as Jenny. Casting consultant was Ann Tate with Catherine Kester. Recording engineer was John McCarthy, with sound effects by Anton Zabo. And the production assistant was Nancy McElveen. Original music was composed and arranged by Marsha Coffey and recorded and mixed by Brian Pape. Series script editor is Sandra Rabinovich. Series musical theme is by John Roby. And the voice of Vanishing Point is David Calderisi. The Yellow Wallpaper was originally adapted for the stage by Knightwood Theatre and presented at the Theatre Center in Toronto in 1981, directed by Cynthia Grant. Tonight's CBC Toronto production was produced and directed by series executive producer William Lane.
That was the 31st episode of The Vanishing Point from CBC, May 10th, 1985. And we're either going to squeeze in some music here, or we'll squeeze in a little extra Gene Shepherd at the end of the show, depending on how the time goes. Right now I've got 15 minutes to get the first half of this show on the air, so I'm not going to lollygag. Our lost Gene Shepherd episode for this morning was, from this day in history at least, the Boston rebroadcast was, October 13th, 1969. It's called Beneath Your Feet. And since I haven't had time to preview it with all the other stuff I have to do around here, we're just going to play it, and I'll probably be listening with you at the same time as it's on. From originally WOR on October 6, 1969, a week later, it was in Boston. Beneath Your Feet, lost Gene Shepherd to wrap up our edition of The Dustbin of History here on WBAI New York. ¶¶
We must give you the following disclaimer. Mr. Shepherd is tonight in one of his sickeningly whimsical moods. We would like to suggest for the good of your own taste, well, probably a lot of other things, too. Well, you better just slide right on down the dial, because we prefer to keep a few friends. He's in one of those sickening moods, you know. I have a quote, Ogden Nash, do all kinds of bad stuff. Oopsie, oopsie, oopsie. Sickeningly whimsical. Oh, by the way, speaking of the whimsy of the world here, we'd like to salute Mrs. Mary Byes, who lives in Springs, South Africa. A lettuce-loving mother figures that she has eaten more than 15,000 heads of lettuce in 7 years. And that we quote her to talk about your hang-ups, Dad. We quote her, says, I could not live without having my lettuce every day. Hey, I must have lettuce. I'm in bad mood all day long. If my husband doesn't buy me flowers, I don't need flowers. He brings me home a beautiful head of crisp lettuce. I've eaten 15,000 of them in 7 years, and I'm just beginning. Just. All right, let's go. Come on. Let's salute that old doll out there. Oh, nothing like a little lettuce. You can still scoff till your bird flies out. Yes, quack, 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 quack. Hey, that's not bad, you know. I must admit that. You know what I like? I'll tell you, I'm not a lettuce cuckoo particular. I'm come see, come saw about lettuces. But is it letti? Or is it lettice? It doesn't sound right to say lettuces. No. So we'll say it's letti. Lettices. Now, that's better. Lettice. So, a little classical Latin here. Lettice. So, Kai Coke to you. So, nevertheless, I'm not much of a lettuce man. One way or the other, I've been. Now, I've never just been hooked on it. But you know what I love? Cabbage. Oh, boy, do I like cabbage. Oh, fantastic. I mean, I like cabbage when it's, you take a cabbage, see, and you just lop it right in half. Don't break it up, just lop it right in half, you see, and you put it in a great big kettle, see, with that, covered up with water. And then you put about 19 slabs of bacon in there, see, and you boil that with a little, just a little touch of garlic, just a little wee itsy bitsy wits, just a little bit there. And you put pepper and salt in there, and you boil that, see. You boil that until that lettuce is tender. Ooh, and then you take the lettuce out, see, and then you put a little pat of butter on each half, and you have got something that is so great, it is O-B-S-C-E-N-E, obscene. You don't mind if I throw an extra C in there, do you? Obscene. But it is terrific. Oh, don't you know what obscene is? That's one of them Yugoslavian spaghetti dishes. Obscene palata, they call it. It's terrific, yeah. It's made out of almonds and grape juice. You just crunch it away there. But nevertheless, what a dish. I'm getting all, gee whiz, you know, you get carried away by thoughts of cabbage. And I like cabbage raw. I like it raw. And I like it. What are we getting into here? This is silly. Now, here it is. I told you I was in a terrible, whimsical mood. Speaking of... No, I can't tell you that. I can't tell you that about the three Polish cowboys. I just can't tell you that. No. Not on the air. Oh, by the way, for any of you who would like to know, however, who the three Polish cowboys are, I would be delighted to send it to you if you're over 21. If you're over 21 and you're a bona fide sociological student, we can't just send this out to anybody. And particularly if you're Polish, you'll want to know, because you want to know about, you know, national heritage and all that stuff. So send me, just send it to Ski, that's all. Ski, S-K-I, Ski. You send it here in charge of this station, and we'll send it to you in brown sealed wrapper. We'll also send you, I can't tell him that one. We'll send you the secret of what is a Polish sport coat. We'll send that along. Kind of like that one. But, you know, these things, you know, we don't want to get carried away. We don't want to do a serious show here tonight, no. Oh, by the way, speaking of serious things tonight, would you please give me a little more of that razzmatazz music? We'd like to salute a new sport that's sweeping the world.
Watching them and waving them flags when them saints come marching in.
That's enough. I'm singing pretty good here tonight. We would like to salute, of course, the sports. The world of sports is getting more exciting every day. What with, you know, all the new stuff in sports. Oh, yeah, you know, used to be guys, there were only two or three sports around. Of course, Fred, Al, Big Greasy Thumb. No, that's another kind of sport. But there were only two or three types of sports around. Guys played football, or they played baseball, or, you know, there was the other sport that you see in the Swedish movies. That was about it. But there's all kinds of new sports now. And I wonder how much of it has to do with television. Because, you know, the wide, wide world of sports is always searching out great new sporting events. Like swimming underwater in the mud in the Everglades. Or grandmothers over 74. Yeah, oh yeah, they had that. And have you noticed that every sports announcer on that show is named Jim? And they wear these blue jackets, and Jim keeps turning it over to Jim K. And Jim K keeps turning it over to Jim Fred, Jim Jones. And they keep going back and forth to Amish Gartenpirken, where they're having the one-legged stilt-hopping contest, which is traditional. And, the 1953 Dodge Wrecking Contest. That's always a good one. Yeah, well, that's much different, you know, than the 57 Chevy Wrecking Contest. And, very different specialty, a whole new different class. And it all comes out in bright, clear color. And the newest sport, I can hardly wait for this one to show up on television. A couple of weeks ago in Wisconsin, several male members of the Milwaukee Skydivers Club dropped from 14,000 feet or thereabouts. they dropped and made a jump wearing a pair of boots, a helmet, a parachute, and a frozen smile. Nothing else. Nude parachute jumping is the newest big sport. Now, why? Well, don't. Why? Why do guys walk around with little sticks hitting balls, little tiny balls into little holes? I mean, who knows why? Why does everybody go ape because Ruan Svoboda can hit a little ball over the thing out there? I don't know. No, there's no why to sport, babe. You don't ask why. I mean, I can simply ask you if you're going to get miserable like that and ask those questions, why? You don't come up to a sports announcer and say, why? Why? I can say why about everything, you know. Why? I mean, why do we sit by the, you know, by the thousands with our mouths hanging open because some guy's rubbing a piece of string over a piece of catgut and that people write long reams of stuff about it? Why? I mean, why? I mean, it's a good question. Why? All right, they're doing it. But I could just see, you know, this presents a tremendous idea for the wide, wide world of sports. Nude parachute jump. Of course, then they have mixed doubles. Then they have teamwork. And then there's the junior miss classification. It's just groovy. Sounds like a fantastic. You can combine everything. See, and of course, like all good announcers, Jim would not, talk about the real thing that's happening. Like, for example, when they're doing a race. Have you noticed when they're doing these big races at these big tracks all over? You never hear old Big Jim there, who's doing the play-by-play for the Wide Wide World of Sports. He always says, and there goes Mario Andretti. Wow! He's running number three in his Lotus Ford. Wow! There goes some blah, blah, blah. There he goes. Wah! And he never tells you, of course, that the real secret why everybody's out there, they're waiting to see some guy go right through the fence, trailing smoke. But he never says that. It's as if we're all interested in the national point ratings. Well, now, I can just see Big Jim Jim. This chick jumps out of this Cessna at 3,000 feet, and the zoom camera picks her up, and, of course, then they got another Cessna flying right above, and he picks it up from that angle. Somebody picks it up from another angle, and there it is on the screen, the brilliant color. And Jim Jim would say, and there goes Lesbia O'Toole. She's number 7, as you know, in the National Point Championships in the skin diving parachute jumping contest. She's doing a beautiful figure eight. There is look at that magnificent number 6 semi-barrel slip roll. And now she's approaching the target area. It looks like it's going to be a good jump. Yes, she just landed. Beautiful landing there. And that was a magnificent jump. That's good for 974 points at least. And now that puts her in second place in today's standings. And now we take you back to Jim Fred in Garmisch-Partenkirchen, who is giving you the skin diving skiing contest that's going on out there. And it's the under 15-year-old girl division. Bring it in, Jim. And see, this is exciting television. And yes, and there was a little piece in Newsday about it. It's, Newsday, the magazine, the paper out here in the out here on the island. It says a couple of weeks ago in Wisconsin, written by Irma Brombeck. She writes a little play, see, about this thing. Irma Brombeck, it says, a couple of weeks ago in Wisconsin, 7 male members of the Milwaukee Skydivers Club dropped into the Running Bears nudist camp wearing a pair of boots, a helmet, a parachute, and a frozen smile. Nothing else. Law enforcement officers satisfied themselves that as long as the skydivers landed in a nudist colony, they were breaking the law. Well, I'm not so sure. Does the nudist colony own the airspace up to, they say, 8,000 feet above? I mean, just as easy enough, you know. Nice little old ladies out there tooling around in her Cherokee with her, you know, with her son-in-law, who's the nice Methodist minister down there from this nice church. Now, they got the kiddies off for an afternoon drive in the Cherokee, and all of a sudden, 3 guys go whistling by. Oh, man. I mean, you know, I just can't get away from it. That man is doing everything he can to break the monotony of being alive. I mean, Now, do you know that I shouldn't bring this up? I won't. I stop it right there. I will not. Do you know that there's a club? No, I won't. There's a club that has to do with things like that. In fact, I ran into this club here recently, a couple of months ago. It's a club. This is the kind of thing. I'm serious when I say this. This is the kind of thing that 50 years from now, people are going to be writing about this period. They really are. This has to be one of the most fantastic periods of the 20th century. I'd say from about 1965 through now, it really is going to be written about, dissected. I remember a few years ago, I used to get all kinds of books mailed to me by publishers and stuff, and I still do, as a matter of fact. But for a while there, do you recall just a few years ago when there was a tremendous amount of writing about the 20s? That they were always writing about the Roaring Twenties, and as if that was the most fantastic, wild time in the history of America. And they were always writing about the 20s, writing about the crazy stuff they did, like, the flagpole sitting, and the guys that would eat goldfish and go over the Niagara Falls in a barrel and all that kind of stuff. Well, that stuff now seems unbelievably tame. To the wild stuff that's going on now. Because, you listen, nobody can tell me that flagpole sitting is anywhere near as nutty than nude parachute jumping. I mean, that has to be. Can you imagine a guy making a really bad landing in a bramble patch or something? Oh, boy. And the thing that even gets funnier about it is obviously the guys that are doing this stuff, you see, the guys that are doing the nude parachute jumping, that they're going to have one hell of a time years from now explaining to other people around why they went nude parachute jumping. It's going to be a very tough to explain. Just like, did you ever meet a retired flagpole sitter? I did. Yeah, we had one in our neighborhood. There was a guy when I was a kid in our neighborhood who had been a famous flagpole sitter. Yeah, it did nothing. Just sit on top of flagpoles. And got to be a celebrity for it. Got famous for just sitting around on his, you know, on the top of a flagpole. And people would come from miles around to see him. And he was retired, though. Did you ever meet a retired Filipino yo-yo champ? Did you know that there were yo-yo champs all around? And they would work in the windows of the Woolworth stores. You see this guy with a T-shirt that would say, World's Champ Yo-Yo. And zing, 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 he's got 19 yo-yos going. He had them attached to his feet and his ears and everything else and doing over and under and loop-the-loop and barrel rolls and all that stuff with the yo-yo. Well, now, that takes a great deal of concentration and work. And then one day, no yo-yo. What does a retired yo-yo champ do? Walk around and rest on his laurels? You don't have many laurels to rest on when you're... Or as I say, did you know? Remember here a couple of years ago when everybody was skateboarding? Well, there were skateboard teams. They went out and did formation skateboard work, and they had the national championships where they would give guys gold medals. And, I don't know where retired skateboard guys go. And so there must be a special junkyard heaven, you know, kind of a special heaven. Well, of course, there's a whole thing about subliterate sports. Yeah, subliterate. There's a, it's really a kind of an under culture of sports. There are certain people, I don't know what it is, how they get drawn into that, but there are certain people who have no interest at all in any kind of legitimate sports. They couldn't care less about the pro football, basketball, hockey, that kind of stuff. But where do they go every night? The roller derby. Yeah, they love to see the San Diego Rockets and the Chicago Bombers. And there's about 28 girls named Tuffy at the Corky, and they wear football helmets, and they skate around and forever and endlessly. Or is it my impression that there is not such a real thing as the roller derby? It's only on late television, and it's done in a studio someplace. But nevertheless, there are people who are fans of this. And yet, they are very closely allied. The same people who like that stuff also go great for things like, the chain gang wrestling team is going to take on the Seven Zombies tonight. And it's a big team wrestling tag match held in mud. And furthermore, it's all dwarfs. Yeah, they go for this stuff. That's a special type. He goes on Monday, he goes to the roller derby, and on Tuesday, he goes to the team wrestling, gigantic tag team Amazon match. Big Bertha is wrestling Goldilocks McGurn in the ladies' team wrestling. Oh, and he gets all excited about it. He takes this seriously. Have you ever watched any of those they're fascinating to watch, these... kind of borderline television shows. And always in the middle of it all, the announcer, he's interviewing next week's wrestler. I've watched these things. And he says, you know, a lot of guys say that this guy, Tornado McGonagall, is good. Well, I want to tell you, and he looks right out at the camera, I want to tell you, Tornado McGonagall, you're going to talk out of the other side of your mouth when I get you next week. I'm going to tell you, I heard what you said in Cleveland last week about me. And, Jim, you know what he said last week? He says that he could tear me from limb to limb. We'll see about that. And I want to tell you fans out there that when next week, when I, Tarzan McClunsky, take on Tornado McGonagall, you're going to see more. I'm just going to break that guy in two. He won't never be able to wrestle no more after that, right? Well, the people who sit out there and really take it seriously, who think this, say, oh, wow, boy, I can hardly wait to see Tornado McGonagall. That's going to be a rat. Boy, I'll tell you, next to the roller derby, Tornado McGonagall is fantastic. And then there are all kinds of subliminal sports like that. Among others are people who go to see donkey basketball games. where donkeys run around and throw baskets. Well, no, seriously, they're the same people. And that's a very special... And they're the same guys, of course, who never miss a demolition derby. They're at every... If you know what a demolition derby is. Oh, they love demolition derbies. Because actually, they're usually the type who are in their own demolition derbies. You know, they're out there, you know, banging into people in their 53 Ford and stuff. And so, yeah, fist fights and all that type. And this is a special crowd of guys. And they even have their own fan mags, you see. Oh, yeah, the wrestling fan mags. It shows on the cover, it'll show a guy dressed like a gorilla. And underneath it says, "Exclusive! The real identity of Gorilla McClonsky, the tornado of the Hungarian rings." And underneath, and it says, yeah, and color pictures, of course, big spread. And this is a special word. Yeah, these people, invariably, this type of guy, this type of person, also goes very heavily for astrology, tea readers, chiropractics. I mean, anything that's, and, oh, they're oh, yes, continually going on a diet of celery juice. And it's a very special crowd of people. It is. I'm not putting it down. It's very special. Of course, it's easy enough to get into this kind of thing, because after all, we're all secretly waiting for some giant male fist to come out of the sky, you know. Oh, yeah, everybody. Everybody secretly knows, you know, that he keeps ad-libbing his life. And so some guys, their life makes sense by going down and watching the Team Dwarf wrestling tag match done in the mud. Another guy makes it by going, sitting and watching Isaac Stern play Prokofiev. And I'm not putting anybody down because, you know, we're all in it together, man. Another guy goes down and watches the Four Slobs with 7,000 watts of rock audio. Yeah, another one goes to Swedish movies and thinks he's going to the cinema. Another one goes to the Stag Films at the American Legion Hall there on a Saturday night at 3 o'clock in the morning. And everybody's trying to do his thing. You know, everybody's trying to work his own little shtick there. He's trying to get, you know, make it work. And you can't put anybody down. I can't, personally. I never can put culture hounds. I can't take them seriously. And culture hounds come in many different directions. They, first of all, they're very intolerant and a culture type. Of course, everybody, even the most cultured type people, they have their own little thing about sports. Their idea of sport, of course, is to read George Plimpton. George Plimpton, who writes about pretending he was a chess master and playing Bobby Fischer. And that's their way of getting the vicarious kick, the in. And yet, at the same time, they're admitting, you see, they don't want to admit that they like chess or golf. What you like is literature. And so, if you can get a recognized writer to write about the slob world, which is the sport world, according to most culture people, then you've got the best of all possible worlds. You got it going both ways. But the little sneaky fears that most people feel, like the other day, see, I'm sitting in the barber shop, and this guy's clipping my hair and going around the back there, and I have the Times, and I brought it with me here, see, because it was a great cover of the Times. It was a Monday, you know, it was a Monday, and I got the Times, and on the front page is a picture of this thing. The smoke is coming out of it. Do you remember that front page article in the Times? I'm quoting now. It says, "Earth crack peril growing in coal areas," by Ben A. Franklin, special to the New York Times, Scranton, Pennsylvania. Mrs. Mary Pat Cabbage could not open her front door to go to church last Sunday morning. It would not budge. Across the street, Mrs. James Abbott was preparing hot cereal at her stove when her kitchen began to tilt toward the backyard. A 2-inch crack opened in the wall next to her refrigerator. The crack zigzagged from there down the south side of Jackson Street in Scranton, parting foundations, tilting stoops and porches, twisting and bending houses, splintering wood siding and plaster walls, rumpling linoleum, and opening fissures in yards. This great crack that's heading towards an abandoned coal mine. And it's just a big crack in the ground. And here's a picture of a guy standing here looking at it. And listen to this. This is why people are vaguely afraid. Have you noticed that all of us, that there's a great deal of excitement about space exploration? Everybody is interested in space, even if he puts it down, because he can see it. You look up and you can see the stars and the galaxies. You can see the heavens out there, see? Right? And so it isn't really that mysterious, because you can see it. And people are even interested in underwater exploration. You know, skin diving. Did you read that great piece a couple of weeks ago about the treasure diving off the Florida Keys? Did you read that piece? The tremendous treasures that they know are down there? These great Spanish galleons. Well, that excites people. Because we can see the ocean. It's a little scary, but not mysterious. Well, it is mysterious, but not frighteningly mysterious. There are certain areas, though, that people never talk about. They never discuss. Like the Earth. Have you ever wondered about what's just below your feet? In the Earth itself? I mean, right down there. You couldn't raise a thin dime for Earth exploration because people are scared of it. Oh, the Earth is connected with a lot of things. Being under the Earth. And here's a picture in the Times. It shows this man standing outlined against the sky. And you see all around him, you see this mist rising. And a crack in the ground. Smoke, sulfur fumes, and steam rise over fire in an abandoned mine near Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. The soil is so hot, 1,000 degrees, that at times only hot water runs from the faucets in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. A great raging fire below the surface of the earth. Do you know how hot 1,000 degrees is? 1,000 degrees the soil is. It just keeps going on and on. Well now, when you think about the earth, down inside that earth, there's this great ball of totally molten core. The earth is like a giant golf ball. It's got layers. And down beneath one of the critical layers is that hot, molten, fantastic innermost core of the Earth. Oh, there's been a lot of scientists are constantly fascinated by it, and they're always trying to get people to throw in a couple of bucks in the hat to send down a big, deep bore, you know, to drill down through this special core. I don't know what the various levels are called, but there's one level that they've never been able to reach, and I don't know what the deepest that they've ever bored down into the earth. It's a couple of miles, maybe, but that's not much when you stop to think that the earth is how many thousands of miles through. It's a tremendous piece of real estate here. So they haven't really penetrated far into the earth compared to how far we penetrated into space. You know, stop to think of it. We've already gone to the moon now. It's 250,000 miles away. And the amount of actual penetration into the earth has been minute, tiny, compared to the earth itself. What can be penetrated? Well, this vague sense of fear about the earth is never said. It's unspoken. And I think it goes back into so many of the depths of our soul that that probably even now listening to this, a lot of people are a little disturbed, because the earth is connected with many things. For one thing, we sprang from the earth. We did not spring from space. We sprang from the earth. And for that reason, it's connected with the origins of man. It's connected with the origins of all animal life that came out of the earth. And hence, it's also connected with the end of animal life. If anything creates something, it also is the end of it. And so maybe people think of the earth that has to do with graves, and it has to do with death and life and all much, much more profound things probably even than space. And you know, once in a while, have you noticed that there's all kinds of myths about the earth? Strange, is like underground myths. There's a sect of people, for example, a cult. You probably run into this. There's a cult of people who believe that the earth is hollow. And they believe that inside the earth is a whole other world. Now, they really believe this. I'm just throwing it out. I'm not saying whether it's true or not. Obviously, a geologist would laugh at this. I'm simply telling you what people believe. They believe that it's hollow, that the earth is like a light bulb, and that inside the earth is another sun. And that sun heats that area down in there, and that there are seas and there are continents and everything down inside. And that it is peopled by another race of people that originally lived on the top of the earth like we do, but because they realized that the earth was going to hell in a handbasket, and that they went down somehow, they got down, and I think it has to do with the Antarctic or the Arctic, not sure, but they were able to get into the interior of the earth, and they have been completely cut off from the outside world for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. They lived down there. And there are people who really seriously believe this. You've probably seen ads for that. It'll say, the secret book of hidden secrets. There'll be an ad. It says, did you know that an explorer in 1908 discovered the secret passageway in the North Pole, where the people who live within the earth, the subterraneans, they are called, gain access to the outside? Have you read that stuff? Get this secret hidden information. Not everybody is ready for this information, which has been suppressed by the ages. You read this stuff. There are also people who believe that we are constantly being visited by visitors from subterranean life, and they come up through elevators. Did you know that? People believe they come up through special elevators that are in major cities all over the world. And looks like any other elevator in a building. And you see this guy come out. You see this guy come out, you know, he walks out of the, close the door, Bill, thank you. He walks out of the building. You think, come on, Bill. Hey, man. You know, they're delivering the ice here for the 23rd floor. But this is fascinating to me about the various cults about the interior or the subterranean parts of the earth. And, of course, there's a lot of reasons for this. And if you live in a city, you don't know about these things. Because I think a big city, the one thing that a big city does, it gives people a feeling that there's no such thing as nature. There's only the mayor. And, you know, that's a force of nature. I wonder how many kids who are protesting really are city kids. I'm curious about that. And they believe that everything stems from the mayor and what they call the establishment. And it's very common here in New York that a couple of months back, in fact, last winter, why the city almost, they were practically ready to lynch Lindsay because it snowed. He really got bugged. He really loused that one up. And, people here in this town, they believe these things strongly. It rains, they look out and say, well, we're out in the city, New York, look at this. Somehow, it's raining on New York, and that shows that New York has failed again. Well, now, it's easy enough, then, to transpose yourself and to believe that people also create human nature. See, we're part of nature. That's a hard thing to accept, boy. And since we are a part of nature, we are this thing. Now, we can fight against it, but we are this thing. So to believe that that it was the system that created sneakiness in people, it was the system that created the cruelty in people, or racial prejudice or bias, is to not understand man at all, friend. Oh, man, I'll tell you. If you really believe that a system creates greed or a system creates evil, friend, you got yourself a real, well, I should say a shock of disillusionment coming. A real shock of disillusionment. But that's very natural. I mean, when you live in a city urban situation where almost everything can be controlled. A kid can live almost his entire life living in an air-conditioned world where it never snows and it never gets cold, never gets hot or humid. You just turn up the dial or turn it down. He gets in the car and he never even sees money. The old man's got a credit card. You don't worry about that either. So you drive down the street, they fill up the gas, and that's the end of it. No problem. So ultimately, you have there is an illusion that's created. And the illusion is that everything can be controlled. And when it isn't controlled, somebody loused up. Somebody. Yeah, we're living in an age, I think, of the universal blame. We're living in an age of total, well, not guilt, because nobody will accept guilt. But let's put it this way, total I suppose you can say accusation. There's always somebody or something that is responsible for everything that happens. Well, I I don't think if you live outside of the city, you're as prone to be like that. Because there are too many things that happen in your own world that you know. You just know that are out of control. Have you ever noticed the strange look in the eye of airplane pilots? Well, a lot of people think they get that way from looking into the sun, squinting into the, you know, this romantic thing. Well, I'm an airplane pilot. And I can tell you that airplane pilots have that funny look and that strange kind of humor that they all have because they know there's better and bigger. I shouldn't even say better. Let's put it this way. More colossal things out there. More gigantic things than Lindsay. Oh, yeah. And the innocence of people who read in magazines and newspapers about airplane crashes, they just think that an airplane crash, somebody loused up. Oh, no. A lot more going in that world, friend, than that. Sailors, too, have the same look in the eye. Deep water sailors. Because one day, the big water just makes a big sucking noise, gone. Or that great big wave comes out of the west, whomp, gone. Who loused up? It's academic. If that. In fact, it isn't even academic. And as that hulk, that twisted steel hulk, goes drifting down through the green depths, deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper, until finally it settles into the silt 2,000 feet below the surface of the sea. The dark silt. The question will never be answered. If there is even a question. And that even supposes there's an answer. We had this underground fire in our neighborhood. Nobody knew how it started. A vacant lot. And you see these little wisps of smoke come drifting out of it. Nobody could walk over this ground because the earth was so hot. And there were rumors around, a lot of rumors, that kids had fallen in one time when they were chasing a fly ball. Out in deep right field. and they started to run across the underground fire. And it just sucked them in. The great ancient primal subterranean flames. Yeah, hellfire, if you prefer it. If you prefer it, a geological phenomenon. But always, deep down under your feet, no matter where you're walking around, if it's Boston, if it's Yonkers, Fordham Road, San Francisco, Bangkok, Tokyo, Nome, Alaska, New Delhi, Shanghai, no matter where you walk, as you walk around, deep down under your feet, endless stretching, unimaginable miles below you, is this great, raging, hot ball, this fantastic, this core of enormous, melted, what is it? Lava. They say that there are gases in there that man has not even discovered. Why? Because the temperatures are much higher than anything we can even create. In fact, there are temperatures that approach the core of a nuclear explosion. Yeah. And the great fear is one day a crack will open, and it'll all start pouring out. A fantastic tidal wave of Ennsville. Great, great hiss of steam, and that'll be it. Then there are other theories that the Earth will just cool off. And so the theories go back and forth. But nobody drills the holes. And in Scranton, PA, big crack goes wandering down the main street. The soil stands at 1,000 degrees. And a wisp of smoke rises into the autumn air. You could smell it. It has a strange, unearthly smell, and yet it is a total earth smell. Because it's the earth itself that's burning. Yeah, who knows the evil that lies in the heart of the earth? Only the shadow knows. And he ain't laying it on you, friends.
Gene Shepherd from This Day in History, October 13th, 1969. That's the date of the rebroadcast in Boston from the show originally broadcast a week earlier in New York City. Well, I guess we had neither time for music or more Shepherd. Yeah, but at least you got Christopher Columbus from the Cheap Suit Serenaders at the top of the show. All right, I'm your janitor and curator, Max Schmid, here in the dustbin of history, and inviting you back next week for another 2 hours of, Chapter 2, and maybe more, of The Princess Stakes Murder from the Zero Hour with Howard Duff. Not Sam Spade, but an amazing simulation. Should we do another Vanishing Point, or two episodes of the Zero Hour? I don't know. We'll know better a week from today. And, of course, Lost Gene Shepherd on every week's program. By the way, you know, we have a Facebook page called The Dustbin of History, and you can become a member of it just for the asking. You answer a few simple questions. They're not weighted, but if you say you like the host, then that might be extra points. But you answer a few questions, so I know that you actually listen to the program, unlike many requests that I get from around the world, from people who have no idea what the program is about. So we weed them out with these questions. But just ask. Go to the Dustbin of History. Ask to become a part of it, and chances are we'll let you in. I don't know what good it does you, but we do post somewhat in advance of the program what's coming up that night, so have a look. And check out our other Facebook page, facebook.com/Max Golden Age, where you'll find out all about the comings and goings on our two shows called The Golden Age of Radio, one here on WBAI Sunday nights from 8 until 10, the other being on the Internet every Saturday morning at 11 a.m. on yesterdayusa.com. A new two-hour program every week, followed by an encore presentation from about 10 years ago. So check that out, facebook.com/Max Golden Age. And, of course, if you'd like to email me, I am max@wbai.org. That's me, Max Mead. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back next week with more rushed mayhem. Stay tuned, K-Wave USA, K-Pop, nothing but K-Pop, with Emerson Unger, follows next here on WBAI New York. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. So long, gang.
Hi, George. Well, finished with the show. What do you want me to do now?
Did you have a good time in there?
Yeah. Oh, boy, it was fun.
Great. How'd you like to do it every day?
Yeah, yeah. That would be neat. Hey, wait a minute. Do I still get to be the janitor?
Sure.
Oh, okay. It's a deal. Well, I'm going to go clean the bathroom.
Attention, please, for an important secret message in Annie's Mystery Radio Code. Get your pencils ready. Now, here's the message itself.
Well, you know that local station board meeting that I've been telling you about that takes place this Wednesday, October 13th at 7 p.m.? Well, I've been pointing people to the KPFTX website where you can find the access information for the meeting, which will be held via Zoom. However, I've also been reliably informed that most WBAI listeners do not have a computer. So now I'm going to tell you how you can dial into the meeting yourself. By the way, the meeting is accessible to the public and includes an opportunity for public comment. So here's what you got to do. You can access the meeting by calling 929-205-6099. You got that? Write it down, kids. 929-205-6099. And then you enter this meeting ID, 922.457.2995. Got that? 922.457.2995. And since that wasn't nearly enough numbers, there's also a password. The password is 995, like WBAI's frequency, 99.5. So it's 995.995.99. Did you get that? 995.995.99. And we hope you will join us at the WBAI local station board meeting Wednesday, October 13th at 7 p.m.